Good afternoon. You are joining Bill trying to get into his chair.
Oh, no, I'm in my chair.
You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Morton.
Bob is where all the good music comes from, just so you know. Okay, so we've had a busy week, lots going on, and I hope you were able to listen to the archive of last week's show, because it was really good. And just a little FYI, we do have Claire Lopez on for 2 hours, just all by herself, so we won't have the Bruce and Claire over-talking, although it is kind of fun. But Claire will be on, it drives Bill crazy. I think it's on December 10th. I'm pretty sure. I'm putting it on the website for you, but something to look forward to. When we all get distracted by Thanksgiving and Christmas and all that jazz.
Now, will Claire be driving or will she actually be stationary?
I'm thinking Claire will be in one place because we set that up. We planned way ahead. December 10th is way ahead for us. All right. So this morning, we're going to start off with Robert Ault, who is the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute. I do hope you go on and read his bio because it's awesome and extensive.
For you Ohio State football fans.
There you go. And
got those Buckeyes?
Maybe I'll have him tell what the Buckeye Institute does, but I thought I'd give a couple little blurbs here. Because, I don't know, it's kind of weird to talk about yourself, so I'm not going to ask him to talk about himself yet. So he is a nationally recognized scholar with expertise in legal policy, including criminal justice, national security, and constitutional law. Prior to heading the Buckeye Institute, he was the director in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, serving under former U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese III at the Heritage Foundation, where he regularly advises members of Congress and Supreme Court litigants on complex legal arguments and strategy. So he's not just going to be making stuff up, bottom line. And we're talking about workers' voting rights today, which is kind of an interesting topic for us, and he has a very interesting take on it as well. So, Mr. Ault, are you in there, and can you hear us?
I am here and can hear you, and I'm glad to be on the show today. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on. The more we read, the more we wanted to know, and then we just thought, okay, he's going to have to come on and give us the 411 here.
Absolutely. So to answer the question, I heard we are not associated with the university, but we are fans of the Buckeye football team.
There you go.
State law here in Ohio. you get a Woody hat when you cross the state line. So,
it's a rule. If you're going to live there, you've got to be a fan. No?
Oh yeah. You do that, and you have to have some sort of a skeptical eye toward Michigan. It's all part of the pack.
So it's probably easier if you come there as a child. You just get indoctrinated as a child. You know nothing different. So,
yeah, but the Buckeye Institute, we're a free market think tank and do work on legal and economic policy. And recently we've been taking a look at worker voting rights, in part because as we did some research, we came across what I think is a pretty startling statistic, which is that 94% of union workers in America have never had the opportunity to vote for their union representation. And this is largely a function of the fact that the elections to put the unions in place to represent bargaining units are functionally something like one and done elections. Once they're elected, there's no need or even opportunity to ever have a vote again. And so to give one example, just to sort of paint a picture, here in Columbus, Ohio, where I live, the local teachers union is the Columbus Teachers Association. That union was voted in as the bargaining representative back in the late 60s when Richard Nixon was still in the White House and the Beatles were still together.
Wow. They should have a pretty good handle on how it all works then, I guess, huh?
Well,
presumably.
But think about it from the perspective of a teacher. You walk into the average elementary school in my neighborhood, the teacher who's up in front of that classroom very likely wasn't even born in the late 60s. So they've never actually had the opportunity to vote for whether or not they want this union to be representing them, whether they'd like another union to be representing them, or whether they'd like no union at all. That's never a question or an opportunity that they've had, and yet they're required to pay union dues or agency fees to that union to represent them.
Now, were these folks originally voted in, or were they just appointed, or how'd that work?
Generally speaking, the mechanism is they are voted in by the workers in the bargaining unit, but at this point, you know, you've got many. The example I gave isn't even the most egregious in many of these examples. It would have been someone in your grandparents' or great-grandparents' generation, perhaps, who voted in that union. And you've never actually had a vote. You come and take the job. The union's already there. And if you happen to be in a state like California or like Ohio that's not right to work, a condition of your employment is paying your union dues or your agency fees if it's a unionized workplace. And which is to say, if you don't do it, the employer is required to fire you. And yet you never have had the opportunity to actually have a vote for that particular union. It denies these workers a voice. It denies them any kind of a choice. And there could be choice with regard to the unions representing them. And I think it's fundamentally unfair.
Well, you know, I've never been in a union, and I apparently don't study them much, but I didn't even realize there could be a different union. I mean, it just seems like every, you know, these guys are such and such local number, whatever, and I never thought about where they came from. You know, there were other choices. So a teacher's union could, I mean, teachers could have, where do you find a different union? Are they just?
Oh, sure. There are a couple of different big national unions. The National Education Association, which has, for instance, in Ohio, the Ohio Education Association. You also have the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, which has local affiliates. But sometimes, even within workplaces, you could have different unions representing different individuals in the workforce. So, for instance, here in Ohio, we actually published a blog a while back by someone who was working for us, and his mother had been a school bus driver in Ohio, and the school bus drivers were represented by the Education Association, by the teachers union, and they weren't doing a very good job. And they were actually able, it's quite onerous to switch unions if you don't have worker voting rights, but they were actually able to switch and get the Teamsters to come in and be their union. They were much happier with the Teamsters representing them. So that's just one example, but there are a couple of different teachers unions that operate. And again, if there actually were the opportunity for there to be greater competition, I'm guessing that there would be more unions pop up. And in fact, in some states that have done labor reform, you've seen small independent unions that have cropped up to be able to address the specific needs of the workers. And that's really what we're talking about in this, is making the unions more responsive and giving the workers a voice and a choice. Right now, 85% of union workers who we've polled think that having regular periodic elections for their unions, their union representation, would make those unions more accountable to them. And that tends to be one of the biggest complaints we hear, which is, look, we pay these union dues, but it really doesn't matter what level of service they provide. If they provide good service, bad service, or no service at all, they're still going to get the dues. We don't have a vote, a real opportunity to vote them out. And so because of that, there's just not an incentive. There's not the competition that you would have if there was the possibility of replacing them with a different union in order to actually hold them accountable.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I guess I always thought if you were a teacher, you were in the teachers union. I didn't realize there were a whole bunch of little options. But I think if people did have options, maybe the unions would work better. I speak with people all the time who are having some sort of issue at the workplace. And at the end of the day, I have asked quite a few of them, well, don't you have a union? Oh, yeah, but they basically side with, you know, whatever the management, I guess, is the best way of putting it. They seem to be wholly owned by the management. And so if the management wants to do whatever they want to do, the union kind of backs them, which makes it even more stupid to be in a union, I guess, from my perspective.
Well, if you go to our, if you go to our website, workervotingrights.org, we've got quotes, one from a very prominent public sector union head who admitted in a state in which they enacted worker voting rights, they admitted that before worker voting rights were in place, that they had taken their workers for granted, that they weren't even communicating with them well, which, again, just goes to this question of if you're not subject to competition, if you aren't subject to regular elections, there's just not that incentive to provide the higher quality of service. And we've all seen this in the private sector.
Sure.
I mean, for those of you who aren't union members, I mean, I remember the bad old days of cable companies. I don't know if you all do. Back when, you know, there was one cable company that provided service to your neighborhood.
Sure.
And you called for an installation, they'd give you a time frame sometime between noon today and 5 p.m. next Thursday.
Yeah.
But competition came in. All of a sudden, you're getting shorter time windows. They'll text you when they're on the way. The prices are going down. The quality is going up. Competition is good. It, you know, oftentimes, those who businesses fight competition, but when it comes in, it makes everyone better. And there's no reason to believe that that wouldn't be the case with regard to unions. And certainly, if you look at union members, how they feel about it, they certainly feel like having that kind of voice and choice would create better opportunities and better accountability.
Sure, because they're the ones footing the bill, and you know, if they're not getting the service, then they're the ones being hurt by it. We've got to take a really quick break, and then we will come back with our guest, Robert Ault. We are speaking about workers' voting rights today from a perspective I think most of us either haven't thought of, and if you're out there in a union, kind of hoping Robert's got some ideas for you here by the end. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Third boxcar, midnight train, destination Bangor, Maine. Oh, worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues. I smoke old stogies.
Old classic.
Nice. So Robert, we were chatting on the break here in the background and wondering, how do you, if you're in a union, if you're in a place that has a union, but your management oftentimes, at least here
State of California.
In California, if your management, you don't have to be in the union, but they still take the dues out of your check?
Well,
is that pretty common?
Again, if you are, if for instance, you're in a situation, there are some positions that are, you know, I'd have to take a look at how it's structured in California. But there are some positions that you would traditionally think of that might, you know, look like, you know, white collar or management positions that are still unionized. And again, so long as it is organized, at that point, you're required to either, you have two choices. You can become a member of the union, you pay the full union dues, and that includes, you know, that will include some portions of participation that aren't, go beyond collective bargaining. You're not legally required to pay that. Or you cannot be a member of the union, and you still have to pay what are called agency fees. Those are the fees for the collective bargaining services that are provided. But oftentimes, what's included in that ends up being things like, for instance, they include, I think, some of their educational activities and the like. And, you know, there's always some level of scrutiny and skepticism as to how much is included in the agency fees that aren't really core collective bargaining, aren't what you or I might think of collective bargaining, but end up being much more, you know, sort of activities related to, if not explicitly involved in, political activity. You know, so we've all seen that if you've got friends who are members or pay agency fees to the teachers unions, we've all seen the glossy mailers that they get, you know, oftentimes their magazines talking about what it is that they're doing for them, and it ends up having, you know, picture after picture of the individuals in the union standing next to candidates at events and the like, and it, you know, it ends up looking like a soft promotion for those candidates. And this ends up being, again, one of the things that frustrates union members, which is to say, obviously their money is going to do that. And, you know, is this something that they, are these candidates whom they really support? In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. But oftentimes the unions overwhelmingly support one party or another. Nationwide, it tends to be the Democratic Party. They tend to support, you know, if you look at donations, generally speaking, 90%+ of them go toward the Democratic Party. Here in Ohio, interestingly enough, the unions end up giving very heavily to Republicans, at least in the in-state election. So, but whichever way it goes, it, you know, it's one of those things, whether or not that actually reflects how it is the union workers would like their money to be spent is a serious question. And there's very little recourse for the members as to how that's spent in the absence of being able to have something like worker voting rights where they could hold their unions accountable.
Right. And that's I had a relative that worked for the state of California and had to pay union dues, was not a union member, and the only explanation she was given was that she did benefit from the bargaining, I guess the collective bargaining. So what you're saying is probably true for the state of California as well. And, you know, she wasn't happy about it. She didn't really feel that, you know, she was part of the union. Why should she have to pay dues?
Yeah, and this is actually, if you take a look, there was a big lawsuit, went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court a while back. That was brought by a California teacher, Rebecca Friedrichs, and she objected. She chose not to be a member of the union, but she still had to pay those fees, which end up being, in most cases, most of the union dues. I mean, it ends up being, you know, something like 80% to 85% of what the cost of the union dues would have been. And she looked at how it is that her monies were spent, and she saw teachers who were abusing kids and so forth being defended by the union. She saw the unions, you know, objecting to merit as a form of consideration for whether it was compensation or if there had to be layoffs. The unions would fight very hard to prevent teacher merit from entering into the considerations. And she said, look, this isn't what I believe. I don't think I should be forced to speak in this way with regard to collective bargaining. And so she brought a First Amendment challenge, took it all the way up to the Supreme Court, had oral arguments, and it looked very much like she was going to win her case. And then Justice Scalia passed away. And so the decision ended up deadlocking 4-4, so, which means there was no decision issued by the Supreme Court. But because of that, there's another case that the Supreme Court has decided to take up just this term. And so they recently accepted the case for hearing, probably going to be heard early next year. And it raises fundamentally the same questions. Can you force a public sector worker to engage in collective bargaining speech? Now with Gorsuch on the court, you know, it's always difficult to figure out how these things will go, but I think that the case has a decent shot. The fact that the court decided to, you know, the Supreme Court largely gets to pick and choose which cases it wants to hear. It hears less than 1% of the cases that it's asked to hear. So the fact that they chose to take this up again so quickly after the last case really does suggest that this is a question that the court considers to be very important and one that it wants to weigh in on.
Well, there's a huge difference between the public's, you know, the public employee unions and the, you know, the
private sector.
The private sector stuff, the plumbers and the electricians and all that sort of thing. And just, you know, from what I hear, people are pretty frustrated with the public employee unions. They just they feel like it.
Well, yeah. If you're a public employee, should you have the right to walk out? I mean, they tend to have a lot more power than they should. I mean,
it also seems to protect the bad guys. We don't seem to be able to get good people in those jobs because obviously it's longevity and seniority, that sort of thing.
Well, that too.
But they wind up protected and unable to be fired, and the VA is the one that springs to mind, actually.
Well, I just look at, like, city workers. You know,
There's that, too.
The garbage collectors decide they aren't getting enough money, so they go on strike, and all of a sudden the city piles up with garbage. That's a pretty strong bargaining tool to give them what they want. And so they tend to have kind of power over the public in some instances. Do you find that to be the case in most cities?
In some cases, that ends up being a tool to choose. Now, notably, in some areas of service where, for instance, you've got unionized public sector workers, such as safety.
Safety's a biggie, yeah.
Those involved in safety, generally speaking, there'll be clauses that will prohibit them from striking. So, or at least that's the case in a number of jurisdictions. So you couldn't have the police force
go
out
on
strike, for instance.
Well, I was kind of thinking about just the basic bureaucrats out there that are processing things for people. And, you know, we've heard scandal after scandal after scandal with VA. And when you dig down into it, a lot of it is they're protected by their union.
Well, you've got some of that. You also have, keep in mind, I think one of the things that ends up frustrating a lot of folks, and I think it frustrates a lot of the workers as well because it paints them with a bad brush, which is just you've got this sort of strange system with public sector employee unions and politicians wherein you've got unions which end up making very large campaign contributions to politicians and to political parties, which help to get individuals elected. Then, when it comes time for those same public employee unions to negotiate contracts, compensation, et cetera, pensions from those politicians.
From those same politicians.
Those same politicians. You've got sort of folks sitting on opposite sides of the table who nonetheless, one's a campaign supporter of the other. So it ends up, you create this sort of circle,
right.
There. So that ends up being a significant concern. And I think, quite frankly, it's a concern of some of the workers as well. You've got the folks like Rebecca Friedrichs out there who says, wait, no, I don't want, that's not how I want the system to work. That's not how I want to speak. That's not how I want my funds to be used. But they don't have an effective mechanism for raising those objections.
Well, shouldn't.
Thankfully, worker voting rights, through this, there's a provision in federal law which allows the states to provide a remedy for this, and states are starting to take it up.
Oh,
yeah, because I think they should be prohibited from contributing to political campaigns if they're a public sector union. I mean, because you're exactly right. Those people that they're supporting are the same people.
We're dealing with this
to.
In our city council,
yeah,
right now.
It's a vicious circle, and
they keep giving the union increases and all that, and now we're having a big pension
the union
crisis.
Keeps voting them, keeps giving them money to be elected. It's wrong.
Well, and you look at something like the pension crisis, for instance. Oftentimes, unfortunately, you've got this system in which they end up voting for more. Pushing for more and more generous pension packages, ones that don't necessarily track how it is that we've done pension reform in the private sector. I mean, at this point, it's extraordinarily rare in the private sector to find a defined benefit pension system. You may find one, but it's the exception and not the rule. This is the idea that, you're going to get a fixed pension after vesting. And it doesn't sort of matter. It's not about how much you put in, you get out a fixed amount. It's very rare that you see that sort of guarantee anymore. Generally speaking, what they do is they've gone to something like a 401k system, a defined contribution system, where you put in so much, perhaps your employer matches at a certain level, and that helps it depends how the market does and so forth, but you're given a pension that way. By contrast, in the public sector, we still see, many of these municipalities, states, et cetera, clinging to these defined benefit systems, and they are drowning. They are drowning in debt, trying to keep up with it. The taxpayers are on the hook to meet the difference, and it ends up squeezing out. The interesting thing is it ends up hurting workers at the end of the day. It ends up squeezing out the ability to hire more employees because, the pension obligations are so high that prevents them. So you've got, it's in some places they're understaffed. It threatens the actual ability for the jurisdiction to be able to pay out on those pension obligations, risking whether or not the individuals will actually get the money that they've worked so hard for. And so switching to a system that would actually be provide for solvency and for long-term stability would actually allow the municipalities to better manage, to hire more workers, to make sure that those obligations are paid. But you see, and you frequently see, the unions fighting tooth and nail. And again, it's not clear if those questions were fairly presented, whether or not that would be the view of the workers.
Sure.
But, if in fact it's like, okay, you can have this system, but it's not clear whether or not we're going to be able to pay on this. We're drowning in red ink. And by the way, it's going to make it so that we can't hire more policemen or more firefighters because we just can't afford it. Many
sure.
People
and if the city goes
that's
broke,
not, that's not the way.
Yeah. If the city goes broke, I mean, I think it's Loyalton that people are getting paid. I think it's 40 cents on the dollar for their pension, and they're already retired, so they've passed the point where they can actually adjust for that, and they ran it up,
yeah,
and
lost 60% of their retirement,
blew the place up. We've got to take a really quick break, and we'll be back with our guest Robert Ault. He is the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute, and today we're chatting about workers' voting rights. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us. Songs with the word union in it. I did not know that. Okay, so Robert, we kind of extended the break so we could run you right up to the top of the hour without interrupting again. But, all right, we have more questions than we have answers over here.
We're confused.
Okay, so we're like, well, wait a minute, how does that work? Okay, so we're still spinning with the idea that if you are in a teachers union, you could actually pick a different union to represent the teachers in that school.
That's right.
Yeah, we're still processing that.
Now.
Well, not now because there's no election. But let's just say you were in a place that allowed you to choose. I mean, can teacher, see, I always thought that teachers were in the teachers union and there was only one. And I figured, okay, if you're in California, you're in a California teachers union that's part of the big union. I don't know. I kind of thought it was like a food. Yeah, like I thought it was a big national union. It was like a food chain and you were just in your regional area.
Your little sector.
But okay, so if you're a teacher and you got to choose, you could actually be represented by Teamsters?
Well, and it depends upon whether that union represents those voting block or those particular units. But there's
sure.
At least two big teachers unions. You've got the American Federation of Teachers, and they've got local affiliates, and you've got the National Education Association, and they've got state and local affiliates. But you know, I gave the example from you're a bus driver. You know, in some cases, those are represented by the teachers union. In some cases, they're represented by groups like the Teamsters. And the other thing is, of course, we're acting like this is static, like you couldn't have a new union form.
Either. Right, right.
You know, let's say you know, once again, this is the whole question with regard to the cable companies I mentioned. When there was only one company, you didn't have choice. But interestingly enough, once competition got opened up a bit, you saw a bunch of players getting into that space. Right now, why would you start up a new union to represent teachers, for instance, when, if there is a teachers union in place, it's almost impossible for them to change, who's representing them. But if those same teachers unions had to stand for regular reelection, there might be an incentive for you to go ahead and say, you know what, we could actually offer you better services for a cheaper price. We could,
kidding.
We would actually use your money for X. You could have them campaigning against each other to represent those workers. Would really, again, the idea behind this is to empower the workers and put them in the driver's seat.
It's just madness.
And
how
the
exciting.
Key to this, the key to this as well is it genuinely operates in that way. In the states where you've seen it operate, in some cases, the workers are very satisfied with their unions, and they vote them back in. That happened in Iowa recently, where they had worker voting rights elections for public sector unions. There was very high voter participation rates, I think something like 88%, and it was something in the ballpark, I think of 86% or so of the unions statewide were voted back in, were recertified. You've had other situations where a number of unions would get voted out because the workers were not satisfied. Nothing dictates how it is that the workers vote. What this does, though, is it provides something that's been sorely missing for a long time. It provides them with the opportunity to vote.
Sure.
And to actually have a voice, finally, after oftentimes decades without a vote.
How do they become a place that gets to vote? How did those people get to vote and other people don't?
It requires a change either in state or federal law. So the states can go ahead and pass a requirement that public sector unions or some section of them or all of them would have to stand for regular reelection. And they can choose how frequently that occurs. In some states it's every year. In one state, Tennessee, that I'm familiar with, they run the elections every 3 years.
Now these are elections. These are elections to decide which union represents them. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, not the people in the union.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
it's a question of whether or not they wish to continue being represented by the union that's currently represented.
Okay, and then within that union, you also have elections for like the president and the officers of the union. And now, do most unions have those elections as well? Or
most unions do have elections for their leadership, but in terms of that, frequently I feel like from what I've heard that unions don't necessarily feel like they have a great deal of say or like the leadership elections really have as much of an impact on the direction of the unions. Whereas again, doing something like this where you get to choose whether or not you're wishing to keep that union as your representative really provides a much greater level of accountability and voice.
That's interesting because I would think that the leadership of a union would have a big impact on the direction of you know, progress within the union. But you're saying that doesn't necessarily the case.
Oftentimes, again, the complaint that I've tended to hear is that they feel like, you know, when it by the time it comes time to pick whoever the union leadership is, the slate, you know, that you're given limited options,
right,
in terms of who it is that's going to actually be a representative, and so it feels like you don't have as much of a voice in terms of those elections.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a situation like this, where they've actually have to fight, they have to fight to keep your business. You know, in those elections, again, whoever wins, the union is still going to be your representative. And so there's much less incentive for them to change the way they're doing business if you're dissatisfied.
No kidding.
That's interesting.
Well, this is a well-kept secret, actually.
it is, but it's slowly getting out there. In fact, there was a piece of legislation that was dropped in Congress just recently that would also provide for it nationwide. That said, I don't know about you. I spent a lot of time working in Washington, and I don't anymore, and for a good reason. I feel like the real action in terms of getting things done is at the state level.
Unless you live in California, in which case we pray the federal government will come and save us, which is really screwed up.
Send in the federals.
Yeah. Well, maybe the federal government could do something. We're like, oh, what is wrong with this picture? Yeah, because usually the closer to home it is, the better it works.
The bigger change you can make.
Except for here.
If we have a governor who has decided he wants to refight the Civil War.
Yeah. And hey, if you'd like to swing over, you can pay an extra dollar a gallon for gas now, which is great.
Oh, that's always nice.
Uh-huh, it's always spectacular.
Well, let me toss out, a reed of hope even for California, which is to say,
even
the
for
thing
us.
About worker voting rights is that it is wildly popular with union households. I mean, nationwide, it scores in polling between 82 and 85% popularity.
Yep. Oh, you no know, kidding.
Outstanding. Here in Ohio, it's actually 90% approval rating for worker voting rights in union households. It scores better in union households than it scores in non-union households, in polling, by multiple percentage points in every poll I've ever seen. And we've done a ton of polling, and we've oversampled union households because we want to know what union workers think on this. And the answer is they want to have that voice and choice. So even in a place like California, where, again, you've got very powerful public sector unions, the workers, the folks who they're supposed to be representing them, really want to have this right. And it's the sort of thing, I think, based upon that, the politicians, you know, should stand up and take notice of this.
Yeah. Well, I guess I've had kind of, you know, obviously it doesn't affect, it does affect all of us, in service and cost and all those things. It does eventually hit everybody. But since I'm not in a union, I had kind of figured in the back of my mind, unions were sort of headed for the scrap heap of history, just because they seem to be pretty dysfunctional, but including some competition in there. That's a mm-hmm. whole, that's a game changer. Does private sector union have that as well?
Private sector unions, at least there's not the ability of the states to weigh in the same way. Federal law allows, because of the special relationship involved with public sector workers, unions working on behalf of the state and local governments, they have the option of providing for these regular elections. For private sector employers, there's not a similar option, at least not under state law. Is my understanding. I believe that would have to be done through federal legislation.
Okay. And what about the, like, SEIU? That seems mm-hmm. to be, like, the catch-all union. I'm always surprised that somebody's in SEIU. But we've got all sorts mm-hmm. of people doing all sorts of things. Are they just another option? They could have picked something different?
Again, the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, represents a number of different public sector employees. They've tried to extend out into
everything.
A lot, I think sort of the new areas they've grown into are things like home health care, or childcare and the like. But again, if you happen to be represented by them, this sort of system would allow you to choose to see whether or not you feel like you're getting good services or not from the SEIU. And if you're not, you could choose to either reject the representation or see if there's another union that might be able to provide the services for you.
So you could actually vote to reject their services and not be represented by a union at all?
Well,
that's correct.
Yeah.
Well,
under this system.
Under worker voting rights. In the absence of that, let's say, for instance, you were dissatisfied, you were represented by a union that was you're one of these teachers, you're in a school district where, again, the union was voted in before you were born, you're not happy with the services you're getting, you'd like to actually vote them out. The system that currently exists in order to do that is extraordinarily difficult, and it places the burden on the worker. In Ohio, again, where I'm a little bit more familiar, just use that as an example, you have to begin by collecting a number of signatures in a very short period of time to be able to hold a certification election. And just to put into perspective, in many cases, you would have to collect more signatures in order to actually, have this election than you would have to collect if, let's say you wanted to become the governor of the state of Ohio. You have this enormous number of signatures to gather. I think you've got about 2 weeks in order to do it.
Oh, wow.
It's very difficult. And then you have to have the election. It does happen on occasion, and it has happened, but it is really quite difficult. And that's just not generally speaking how we do things in this country. We don't say, we're going to have one election, we're going to bind you in to being represented by, a particular group. We're going to require you to pay fees or dues to that organization. And it's going to go on for not just for your lifetime, but for decades to come. And if you ever want to change it, we're going to make it extraordinarily difficult for you to do that. That's just not fair. It denies a legitimate voice to these workers. Having these regular elections, as we've seen it, in some cases the unions win, as they did in Iowa. In some cases they don't. But in all cases, the workers actually are the ones who decide, and they get the voice and the choice with regard to their representation.
That's great. So if you had a chunk of people in the union and they were thinking, we didn't really, they're not maybe high enough up on the totem pole to really understand the big workings of the whole thing, but they're thinking, our union's crummy, and they're, they're doing a kind of a bad job. They live in a state like this where workers' voting rights are not allowed or mandated, or I'm not sure which way you look at it. What do they do at this point? They have to change the law for the whole state, or can they collect enough people to toss their union out? How do they do that?
Yeah, how does that work?
Once again, they've got a couple of options. They could try and decertify their union, and they could see how it, once again, it is possible. It's difficult, but it is possible.
Yeah.
But additionally, they could look to change the law in the state. And if they're interested in doing that and learning, what worker voting rights, how it works and how it might work for them, first thing I would say to do is to go to our website, workervotingrights.org. We've got information about the law on it. We've got information about how it works. We've got white papers and videos and a ton of resources to help you out. And then additionally, if you need more information after looking at that, I'd say please contact us, contact the Buckeye Institute. We'd be happy to chat with you all about how worker voting rights works and how it could work for your state.
That's awesome. Mm. Well, we'll post all that for people for a resource, because I'm just guessing, but I think a lot of people are just, drilling along under the system that they're on, trying to maybe not have to pay dues to the rotten union if they're rotten, and they figure that they're kind of trapped. So, kind of nice to have choices, even in California.
Choice is good.
Yeah, choice is always better.
Even in California. And we did see, I think all of us, and who've been around a while and paid cable bills, that's a really good example because it did used to be.
Oh yeah, there was one game in town, and you had that or a big antenna on your roof, and that was it. You paid one company.
Well, we see it with the power companies now. I mean, you choose, you know, around here anyway, you choose your housing because it's so hot here in the summer. You choose your housing based on who controls your power because you picked the wrong place, mm-hmm. and you got an $800 bill every month.
You got two rents to pay.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome. Yeah, living here is expensive. And that makes it kind of silly. But, we'd like to have everybody'd like to have some choices, I think. This has been really interesting. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the information. And we will definitely send people workervotingrights.org. And I don't know. I think they should contact the Buckeye Institute and find out how to help themselves, because there are a lot of people out there, I think, who could really benefit. I think it would help our public sector services, too. If people weren't so frustrated on the job or, you know, weren't being led around by the nose, I think they might get more done. So, as a taxpayer, I'd be a big fan.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on. We do appreciate it. Great information.
Thanks for spending your Sunday afternoon with us. I hope people do go to the website and pull up some of those links and check out more that Robert Ault and the Buckeye Institute can do for you. Thanks, Robert, for coming on.
Thank you, Robert.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. And Bob is playing some sort of song that requires explanation.
Oh, you will remember it.
International Ladies, what?
Garment Workers Union, one of the most popular commercials of the 70s.
That's right, the union label.
Get out more, I missed that. Good afternoon. You are joining the second hour of We the People Radio. First hour, we chatted about worker rights. And Bill's trying to do my job for me.
Oh yeah, I meant no disrespect.
He's over here giving me smoke signals on what I'm supposed to do next. What the heck? I don't like to do it the same every time. You know that.
Oh, my gosh.
I'd be a terrible factory worker. All the cars would look different.
I meant no disrespect, Louie.
Couldn't have made the Ford Fusions that we all own right now because they would all look different. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Okay, so what I was going to say is in the first hour, we talked about workers' voting rights. So now we're going to do a dramatic shift. However, we're going to go back to the Clarion Project. We had somebody from Clarion Project 2 weeks ago. So these guys have all sorts of interesting topics that they cover, and they have an amazing cast of characters, I guess, as we say. So one of their advisory board members is Rahil Raza. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. And she is a Clarion Project advisory board member. I'll just read what I have.
A founding member.
I should not ad lib. Yes. No, she's a founding member of the Muslim Reformer Movement and an international human rights advocate. She has an amazing video. She's got a bunch of amazing videos. She does a terrific blog. There's a lot of great information on there. We've linked all of that on the website for you, and I do hope you'll do some homework there. I don't want to read any further because then we'll be giving away her message, but I think you'll like it. It's something that we all think, but we're not allowed to say, and she's allowed to say it, so I'm going to let her run with it. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is a message that needs to get out desperately. But if we say it, we're racists and haters, so why don't you fire away with your thoughts? I really think you have a great message.
Well, my work as an advisor on the advisory board of the Clarion Project is that we expose radicalization and we give voice to moderate Muslims and progressive liberal Muslims, and this is why I am involved with them. And the message is that there is a global jihadist insurgency out there, that the terrorists have declared war on the West and its values. And we wonder how long it will take for the Western leadership to wake up and understand the depth of the problem. I am a practicing observant Muslim, but I understand that there is a virus of political Islam out there which needs to be tackled, and we can only do that if we can talk about it. And you just mentioned twice that if you talk about it, you will be labeled a racist. But our work is to encourage people to talk about it, because there are ways of having this conversation without being offensive, without being racist, without being bigoted, and it's a conversation that must happen. It's a conversation that should have happened right after 9/11, because what we are faced with is a war of ideas. This is not a war of weapons, it's a war of ideas, and we need to have better ideas and alternate narrative, and that can only come about through open communication, through dialogue, through debates and discussions, and the freedom for people to ask difficult questions. So this is what I do 24/7. I'm a human rights advocate. I go to the United Nations Human Rights Council 3 times a year, essentially to be a thorn in the side of the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a group of 57 Arab Muslim countries, whose only reason to be at the United Nations is to constantly criticize Israel and the United States and any aspect of the West. So according to them, all the human rights aberrations are taking place only in the West, while they are, you know, clean and white as newly washed cloth. So, it's very ironical. And when I, as a Muslim, speak out, especially as a Muslim woman, obviously they don't like it. And so the work that I do is challenging at many levels. But we have discovered, being involved in this, my organization is called Muslims Facing Tomorrow, and it's an organization to bring Muslims into the 21st century. And we critique all aspects of violence and terrorism and radicalization that are out there. And we realize that the frontline warriors in this battle for the soul of Islam, the faith, has to be Muslim.
So are you allowed to
makes sense.
Are you allowed to speak on college campuses?
Well, I have. About 2 years ago, before this situation became so rife with political correctness, I traveled across 100 campuses with a documentary that was made by the Clarion Project called Honor Diaries. And this is an award-winning documentary which exposes the issues of honor-based violence, which is honor killings, forced and underage marriage, and female genital mutilation. And this was screened across about 100 campuses, and I totally understood the challenges that universities are now facing with this, stifling of free speech. But of course, in recent times, like in this past year or so, I haven't been able to do that because now universities are no longer bastions of free speech. There is very little you can say in a university campus unless, of course, you're celebrating Israel Apartheid Week or you're, involved in the BDS movement. Then, of course, you're welcome to lobby and rally and do whatever you want. But God forbid you should have a session about radical Islam. You'll be shut down, you'll be shut up, and you'll be booed out.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Welcome to our world.
You know, 2 years ago, I can see you traveling and speaking at colleges, but in today's environment, you're absolutely right. I can't see you getting within 100 feet of a campus without being shouted down or attacked. It's really sad. There is this free speech on college campuses really is kind of a thing of the past.
Which is where the ideas should be.
That's where they should be debated.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what college campuses are supposed to be. But, it's not sad. It's appalling, and it's appalling that we are allowing this to happen because, look, I am an immigrant. I came from a country where there wasn't free speech, so I value freedom of expression, the right of free speech, even if it means speaking out against something that is part of my own community or my own faith. But we should have the right of free speech, but it's not happening anymore, and this is something that really, really concerns me. And, as far as the issue of radicalization is concerned, I can at least still speak about it because I am a Muslim. But anybody else dare open their mouth, as you said, they'll be slapped with a label of Islamophobia and racism and bigotry. And that's not the way we will ever find a solution to the problem.
No,
because,
it's not.
You know, it's like a virus. It has to be identified. It has to be acknowledged. It has to be isolated. And only then we can find a cure for it.
So as a whole, how are you received in the Muslim community Are you sort of an outcast, or is your message more popular than we might think?
Well, it depends on who you're speaking to. So, you know, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. They are very diverse. They come from varied mindsets. The progressive liberal Muslims who are fed up of this daily, you know, waking up every week to see that there is another terrorist attack taking place, they are very welcoming of the message because, you know, they are, for want of a better word, what we call moderate Muslims. They want to live their lives 9 to 5, be like anyone else, bring up their children, live in peace, and so they welcome the message. But of course, those who are Islamists, and allow me to differentiate between Islam as a faith like Judaism and Christianity and Islamism, which is a political ideology.
Thank you.
And
there,
that is
there
what
is
we
a
are
big
fighting.
Difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a big difference, and it's a very important difference. It's a difference that people need to understand if they want to be part of this discussion and debate. Because, unfortunately, both extremes don't work. Lumping all Muslims under one banner of terrorism is not accurate and not right and doesn't work. And the other side, acting like there is nothing wrong and there is no problem, also doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have a balanced conversation with Muslims involved in it. And so in answer to your question, we started the Muslim Reform Movement about 2 years ago. And since then, it has grown. Our support has grown, not just from Muslims, but from non-Muslims as well, because in actual fact, it seems to be the only solution. And we always give the example of the Christian Reform, which, as you know, is celebrating 500 years this year. So, you know, any reform, any change is slow, it's challenging, it's full of pushback, but it has to start somewhere. And we believe that we've sown the seeds of change and that this is where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the West, from North America. I am very hopeful and optimistic because here we have the freedoms and the safety to speak out, despite
right.
the backlash that we get.
Well, see, in your article, I thought it was interesting, and that was part of the piece I had put on the page, that you contend that it's crucial to criticize white supremacists like the KKK, as we've seen in the wake of Charlottesville, but as a society, Americans must also condemn Islamist supremacists.
And, yes, absolutely.
And it is a double standard that we don't do that.
Yes, well, you know, that millions of people can come out into the streets and rally against the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis and white supremacists, and that's good because that is evil and it needs to be condemned. But similarly, in fact, more dangerous is the evil of Islamist supremacists who not only want to promote their message, but they kill people. In the name
yeah.
of promoting that message. And, you know, this is not just me saying it. All you have to do is look at the past year and see the number of terrorist attacks that took place. And unfortunately, most of them were done by Islamist terrorists. So this is a conversation that we have to have. It's an open and honest conversation because unless we condemn similarly the Islamist supremacists, we are not being true to ourselves. And it's a hypocrisy. And it's double standards. And now we are faced with the regressive left. We are faced with white liberal guilt. We are faced with political correctness. So we are not really moving ahead at the pace that we should. We are in the 21st century. It's been so many years after 9/11. Yet we haven't been able to fight the war on terror.
So
why? Because we are not able to put policies into place.
Sure, we can't say anything.
No, we can't.
Well, I was curious. You probably, I'm guessing you get quite a bit of pushback from your own community, but I'm curious what you think of places like in. I know it happens elsewhere, but the picture in my head is in Paris, where they all break out their prayer rugs in the middle of the street and they shut down all the commerce and transport during periods of time during the day. Things like that.
That's ridiculous. That's a nuisance value. And they're just doing that to get attention. I mean, you know, prayer and worship is a very private matter. As I said, I'm a practicing Muslim. I pray 5 times a day, but I don't have to do it in the street.
You don't run out in the middle of the road, right?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And in fact, you know, the very, very core and authentic message of Islam tells us that your worship and your relationship to God should not be a show. Of public, it's a very private matter. how we behave in the public actually tells people who we are. I mean, you know, if you're an American, you should be a loyal citizen to the country. We must observe and respect the Universal Charter of Human Rights. It's how we behave with each other. But this unnecessary show of piety is something that is not accepted by Islam, and it's something that I'm embarrassed about.
Well, I don't think it actually has anything to do with their faith. I think it has everything to do with putting it in everybody's face. It's like, I dare you to come out and say anything, because then you're affecting my religion, which is obviously
exactly. And they're not real. So cocky about this because you know, the West is tongue-tied when they see something that is being done in the name of a faith, or what they perceive to be done in the name of the faith, because there's a lot of ignorance out there. You know, the faith is not telling us to go out and kill people. This is an ideology. It's an evil ideology. And, you know, I look upon Islamism, the political ideology, like fascism and Marxism, because when that was rampant in the world, everybody, the world globally, got together to condemn it and speak out against it. But now it's Islamism, and because it is somehow connected to a faith, people are afraid to speak out. So therefore, it becomes even more important for Muslims to stand up and speak out. We must clean up the garbage in our own community. We must look at what is happening to our faith and take back the spirituality of that faith. And that is what we are trying to do. You know, as hard as it is, as you asked me, if there's pushback from my own community, of course there is, because they look upon me as some sort of a traitor to the faith. But the point is that it's embedded in the faith to say that we must condemn that which is evil and promote that which is good. So I don't believe that I'm doing anything that is outside the circle of my faith. In fact, the change has to come from within the faith. The reform has to come from within the faith. And therefore, we need to empower the silent majority of Muslims who don't want to have anything to do with any of this, because, you know, it's not pleasant. It's something that is challenging, and they don't want to get involved, but they, by their silence, to me, they are part of the problem. We need as many voices as we can.
Yeah, unfortunately, the voice we hear are the Islamists, supremacists. That's what we hear. How do you fight back? I mean, obviously, they've declared this jihad against the West, and we have all these homegrown or self-proclaimed jihadists here committing these crimes in our country. And they tout that, you know, that's what's written in the Quran. This is how I'm supposed to act.
Well, and that's what they're supposedly taught at their mosque and everything.
Yeah, and how do you change that from the mosque level, where they're being taught this ideology? How do you fight that?
Well, the thing is that it's not an easy process, and it's not an overnight process, but it can be done. It has to be done at two levels. The first level is within the community. You know, we have to stand up to these certain mosques and Islamic institutions from where the messages of hate are coming. You know, first of all, everyone has to understand that terrorism is only the end result of radicalization. The root cause is the teaching of hate and the radicalization, and someone is doing it. There's no such thing as a lone wolf. Someone is teaching these people that to hate and to kill. We have to find out where those messages are coming from.
Well, don't you?
And we have to. Yes. Go
yeah.
Ahead.
Don't you know where it's coming from? I mean, there's mosques out
well,
there
to
that
some
they've
level,
identified.
Yes, we do. Uh-huh. To some level, we do. But it's also the education at home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what parents are teaching their children.
Right.
And I always say this is where we need to empower women, because they are the mothers who will teach their child, their son, either to become a suicide bomber or to become a democratic citizen of the country he's living in.
Well, sure. that was my big question is how does, I mean, we've got to take a really quick break. But when we come back, I really want to know, where does that come from that a mom would, I mean, dads too, but okay, just moms. How does a mom raise a child to strap on a bomb and go die and think that that's a good thing? I don't even understand that. And how long does it take to convince someone of that, in your opinion and what you've seen? We'd be real curious to have some insight on that, because that is a big mystery right there. We're going to be right back. We're here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Bob, the Love Train. You never know where that one's going to pop up. Classic. Oh, my goodness. So we are here with Rahil Raza. She's the Clarion Project Advisory Board member and a founding member of the Muslim Reformer Movement. She's an international human rights activist, and she's talking about the threat posed by Islamist supremacy, which is really hard to say, by the way. It does not roll right off your tongue.
No, it doesn't.
I'm like, I got it, I can't say it. Well, so, okay, talk to us about these moms. How do you get into a space in your head where you think it's okay to sacrifice your kids?
Well, I think you have to understand that a large part of the Muslim world is third world countries,
right,
where their illiteracy and ignorance and lack of education are a main problem, especially for the women. So these women are not independent thinkers. These women don't have individual thought. They have been told and brainwashed in their own lives to believe that this is what is the right thing, and this is what they're doing because this has been embedded into them. And this is unfortunately one of the biggest problems that we have faced, the ignorance, the lack of education, not only secular education, but information and education about our own faith.
Sure.
So, you know, these are ideological mullahs who say whatever they want. I mean, they're promoting an ideology. And of course, this ideology has been promoted on the backs of billions of petrodollars through the oil sands of Saudi Arabia into third world countries. And where they even when they can, they bring curriculum that is so against the core beliefs of the faith that it's mind-boggling. But they've been doing this for 40 years now. I mean, I have two sons. They fit the perfect profile of the so-called Muslim terrorists. They're young, they're Muslim, they're brown and bearded. But I'm the one who's educated them. And they have a mind of their own. They're, you know, we encourage individual thinking, individual thought, and, enlightenment, vision. This is what is needed in the Muslim world desperately.
Well, and if you have a future, you can see. I mean, if you plan for a future, I think about, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my mom was always talking about later, right? When you get to high school, we're going to do this. When you get to college, you're going to do this. Yeah. When you have your own kids. Mm-hmm. And my guess
is very, very important in what we have to do. So in our organization, we have a mandate of the three E's. We say we have to expose the problem, we have to educate the masses, and then we have to empower them for change from within. We are at the very first level of even trying to expose the problem,
It's
no help when you have political correctness stifling open conversation.
Yeah, what about all the dopey white people that are in the midst of this whole thing? Because they're the ones fueling it, really. You've got this whole batch of people that they do most of the silencing. It really isn't the Muslim community. I think it's seems to be mostly the other guys, the non-Muslim community.
It's causing a lot of harm because, let's face it, there is a problem within the Muslim world which we want to deal with. But there's also a problem with the leadership of the Western world that has been so wishy-washy in allowing much of this to happen. And I'll give you an example of the United Kingdom. I'm going there next week. I've been invited to come and speak about Sharia councils that have existed. There are 85 Sharia councils operating in the United Kingdom under the blessing of the government, by the way. Now, in an afterthought, they are finding that, oops, Muslim women have come to them and said, what have you done to us? It's causing havoc in our lives, and now they want to try to change that. So the questioning should be done to the leadership of the Western world as well. Were they asleep at the wheel when they were letting Islamists come in and, you know, just do what they wanted to, even when the law enforcement agencies knew that they were criminals and they were planning and plotting? In the aftermath of the London Bridge attacks, the vehicular attacks in London, law enforcement actually said that they knew some of these perpetrators. They knew that they existed. Well, if they did, then why didn't they lock them up?
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, these are valid questions that we need to ask because, let's face it, the Muslim community alone can't fight this. We need the help of civil society, government, leadership, non-Muslims, everybody, to come together and work from one platform. And that platform is that this is a war of ideas. We have to have better ideas, a better narrative, policies that are different from the policies that were in place even 25 years ago, because it's a different world. A post 9/11 world is a very different world.
Do you find Sharia law getting a foothold here in the United States, and how dangerous is that?
Well, I don't see it happen, but yes, there are Islamists who would like to see Sharia law implemented. And I'm a Canadian. I live in the province of Ontario in Canada, and about 5 years ago, there was a move to have Sharia law here, and we fought long and hard for 1 year, and finally that piece of law that allowed arbitration was actually thrown out. But if given an opportunity, there are people in the West, in America, who would like to have Sharia law. For as far as I'm concerned, there should be only one law for all. If we come to the West by choice, then we should follow the law of the land. And this, by the way, which many people don't know, is an Islamic mandate. Follow the law of the land where you live unless it forces you to go against your faith, which of course it doesn't. So there's absolutely no need for a parallel set of laws because all it does is oppress women. These are man-made laws. They have not been vetted. They were frozen in the 9th and 10th centuries. So obviously they're not applicable in the 21st century. So these are things that are not discussed openly. It's all happening under the table. And it's very, our Western leaders just think, okay, let's look the other way. You know, it's their culture. They want to do it, so let's allow them. Well, it comes to bite you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just creates a nightmare. So you have, I know that they were doing some type of surveillance and they were sending, you know, I don't know, spies, I guess, for lack of a better word. But they were sending people in to keep track of what was going on in these different mosques in places like New York City, for instance. And that's all been deemed to be inappropriate. You're not allowed to go see what everybody's up to and monitor that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that harsh times call for harsh measures. In France and Germany, they now have a law that the sermon in the mosque has to be in the language of the country. And they're also checking the sermons to see that there's no hate messaging there. Mm. And if they find that there is hate messaging, they will close that mosque.
And where is this?
In France and in Germany.
Oh, they finally kind of got the, they finally got some religion, as they say.
So they're doing that. Now, you know, I understand the issue of freedoms and rights and free speech, but, you know, if we know that there are messages of hate and there is, hate mongering coming from certain mosques, which of course there is not all, but from some, then perhaps surveillance is necessary.
I mean,
this is the only measure.
But aren't we really, don't we have to depend on the members of the mosque to kind of self-report when that I mean, if they go to that mosque that teaches hate, I think they're part of the problem. But there's got to be people that attend those mosques that don't agree with that. And don't we have to kind of depend on them to step forward and say, hey, this is going on. What can we do about it?
But so here's the thing. It's only about 20% of the Muslim community that is mosque attending. What happens is that very, very often that they just stop going to that mosque. You know, they don't take action. They don't stand up in the middle of the sermon and say, hey, Imam, what you're saying is wrong, because they somehow are intimidated. Mm-hmm. They think, that this is a person that they can't speak out against. And this is why the problem has become so acute. If the Muslim communities had taken this responsibility and done the self-monitoring, I guess we wouldn't be where we are. And yes, I agree with you. They should be the first line of defense. They should be the ones who should speak out against any kind of hate messaging, against any kind of divisive messaging, because this is something when children hear, when young people hear, then they sort of absorb this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only way that you can hurt another person is if they are dehumanized to you, and if this is happening week after week and you're being told that they are not the same as you and their values are not the same as yours. But the places where the messaging is coming from, they've also become very clever, and sometimes the messaging is very subtle. They're not telling their congregation to go out and kill people, but they're still talking about differences. There's a lot of anti-Semitism. And this is something we should be cognizant of.
Sure. And, you know, it's no different than any other church. If you attend a sermon and you don't like what's being said, or you feel that, you know, what's being said is a hate message, I think you have a responsibility. And I think in most cases, word gets out pretty fast, and attendance does go down, and the word in the community gets out that particular church or whatever it is teaching a negative message. Is that the case with the mosques, though? Because if what you're saying, if only 20% of the people, 20% of Muslims go or participate at the mosque, does that mean that the ones that do participate at the mosques are the ones we have to watch out for?
Well, not all of them, but largely yes, because they are influenced by the messaging. And the messaging is coming either from the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, or from Khomeiniism in case of the Shia Muslims, or from the Salafi Wahhabi ideology. Now, about 5 years ago, there was an article in the Washington Post that said that almost 80% of American mosques were now infiltrated with Wahhabi Saudi money. And obviously, money comes with an agenda.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if that money is being pumped into the mosques, and the messaging is also coming from there. The sermons are also coming from there, and very often they will place in place of a very visionary, moderate imam, they will put one of their own Saudi Salafi imams, and then the messaging changes. And I've seen that happen in mosques. So, yes, it is not being monitored by the communities themselves. So we have a problem. We have a serious issue.
So do we put a moratorium on building mosques? I mean, is that out of the question?
When you talk about religious freedoms, I think it could probably be unconstitutional.
Right, right.
Sure.
It is supposed to be a place of worship. Now, if it was, it would be benign and wonderful if that's all it was, as some mosques are. As I said, not all mosques are giving messages of hate, but the problem is that this influence of the Wahhabis is so big, and there is so much money involved. You know, someone said track the money. You know, and if you track the money, where it's coming from, and by the way, it's coming into American universities as well in very large amounts. So if you track the money, then you understand that these subversive agendas are coming on the backs of millions of petrodollars.
Sure. How?
So, you know, many different levels. Now, in July, I was invited to give testimony to the United States Congress. Clarion Project had arranged for this. And I went and spoke in the U.S. Congress to the Committee on Homegrown Terrorism. And I made 4 recommendations to them. And one of the recommendations was to stop the flow of money coming in from terror-producing countries into our universities and academic institutions. So there is a very strong connection to the financing.
Sure.
Interesting. And what did they say? I mean, was there any, did they just listen?
It was well received, I have to say. They asked very good questions. Whether or not they've taken any action against it, I don't know. I'm just one person, an activist, and a grandmother who's concerned about the future of the next generations. I don't know how much authority they give what I have to say. But certainly, we have been working in this field for over 25 years now. So I would say that I think we have an idea of what we are talking about. But, you know, we can only give advice. We can only expose the problem. The final policies and the change has to come from the top down.
Sure.
So what I'm saying is that the work has to be done at both levels, from the activists and the grassroots people who are working in human rights and who are trying to bring about change, and those at the top level who make the decisions.
And we have to stop knuckling under to allow these guys to get away with this stuff incrementally, the praying in the middle of the street and shutting down, you know, the roads. I mean, that's all incremental stuff to manipulate society, just piece by piece.
Yes, that's civil disturbance, and it should be stopped under the issue of civil disturbance. But, of course, any time there is a faith involved, you know, people are reticent.
Hands off.
In Europe is a very, very good example of a bad situation. We need to look at Europe and say we don't want this to happen here. We have a window of opportunity where we can bring about change. And I believe that, you know, there are Muslim Americans who are loyal to the country who want to see this change, and they should be empowered. They should be brought into the discussion and debate. And together with them, we need to bring about this change.
How can we be more successful getting this message out to college campuses and allowing the message to be heard?
Well, if the college campuses allow people to come in and speak, I think we need to have open
obvious
dialogue
idea.
And discussion.
Sure.
You know, this is if the discussion is squashed, if there is no debate and discussion about the issue, it just goes underground. And then it sort of, you know, bursts open in very unpleasant ways. And we've seen the result of that when people are stifled from asking pertinent questions. As far as I'm concerned, every citizen has a right to question the safety and security of his country and a right to question what is happening with terrorism and radicalization. None of these questions should be off the record. In fact, in our work, we encourage this questioning. And I believe we need to continue to leave the doors of communication open and have many more of these conversations like you and I are having in the civil square, in the universities, in the educational institutions, because when I traveled across the campuses, there was a hunger by the students who are totally ignorant about what's happening because they are being spoon-fed all sorts of propaganda and conspiracy theories.
Sure.
They need to be able to speak to people who are in the trenches, so to speak, and ask them all the questions they have on their mind.
Well, I'm curious, in your lifetime, you said you're a grandmother. I think actually everybody here is a grandparent, so this is like the old people's today.
Old people's forum here.
So you're in old people land. How have you seen it change in, I don't know when you moved to a Western country, but how have you seen this change in your lifetime?
Well, I came 30 years ago, and I've seen it change incredibly. You know, I came with my family to embrace the values of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, gender equality. That's very important to me because, you know, I come from a Muslim country. I was born and brought up in Pakistan, and in my childhood, women were supposed to be seen and not heard. So I understand the values of freedom, individual thought, and as I said, all the freedoms and embracing a liberal democracy. And I've seen things go downhill, especially after 9/11. As I said, the rise of the regressive left, this political correctness, the stifling of free speech, it really is of great concern to me because this is what I left behind. And the rise of Islamist terrorism and the freedom with which they move around, I mean, these people know that they can get away with so much because of political correctness of the mainstream who are not willing to acknowledge that there is a problem.
Well, when you were living in Pakistan, did these things happen in Pakistan and we just didn't know about it until it came here?
Well, I grew up in a very different Pakistan. So this rise of this Islamist ideology is about 40 years old. I can probably pin it down to the time that I left Pakistan.
Okay.
When I was growing up in Pakistan, it was a different Islam. It was a different Pakistan. Very pluralistic. Religion was not puffed down our throat. You know, we had culture, we had art and music. Now these things are considered to be sinful by the Wahhabis. So we saw this wave of this Wahhabi Salafi ideology coming from Saudi Arabia, and that was when we realized, my husband and I, that we had to move out because we are activists, and, you know, we couldn't live under this kind of rigidity, the orthodoxy that was coming in. And so it was, I feel very sad to say it was a very different country at that time because it was not engulfed by the oil money. And as I said, it's all about the money, the subversive agendas. And then, of course, after 9/11, things changed even more. Instead of facing this problem head on, you know, the Western leadership went into all sorts of political maneuverings. And, of course, oil prices have had a lot, a role to play in this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So many leaders have looked the other way at human rights aberrations. I mean, the human rights.
Uh-oh. That sounded bad. She got cut off at the pass. Ooh, let's take a quick break while we call her back.
All right.
She was going to have to leave early. This is a great way to keep her hostage till
the top of the hour,
huh?
You can't just cut off like that.
But we can say that now because she's not listening.
Yeah, you can't just hang up.
She is super interesting. You are listening to We the People Radio. Our guest has been Rahil Raza. She is an international speaker and human rights activist with the Clarion Project. We'll be back. We're going to call her and see if we can catch her again. Stick with us. More good songs. Thanks, Bob.
Sowing the seeds of love.
Sowing the seeds of love. So our guest has vanished into the ether from which she came. And so we're sorry about that.
We have a theory she may have run out of cell phone juice.
Yeah, either that or battery. Because she had a pretty good connection. She might
and
have
then it
on
just
hold.
Abruptly went away.
And who knows what's going on in Canada. Maybe they're having a storm or something. But she had told us, just full disclosure, she suddenly told us at the beginning of the show she could only be on for a half hour. So
we
manipulated the brakes.
Manipulated
so we
a little bit.
We could
got
keep
her
on.
A little longer.
He kept her on for 45 minutes.
I find it very interesting what she was saying about the extremists taking over her religion.
Yeah.
You know,
she said it was never like that as a kid. And, you know, we've heard that over and over and over. We heard that with Fred and Ross, the mm-hmm. Iranians from the American Organization of Iranian States. Those guys, they've said that over and over. Their country was never like that. Look at pictures of Iran back in the 70s. And they were all, it looked Western.
It looked very Western. It looked like a regular city, you know. They dressed like everybody else. And it's interesting how this jihad movement has really crippled the Middle East and all these big cities.
Well, and the
just
bad
fallen.
Part is a lot of it, the people that are rolling over for it, are the people here.
right?
You know, or westernized people, because they don't understand or don't want to understand the danger. It's like, oh, well, that's just not happening.
Yeah.
Well, saying it's not happening isn't good enough.
Well, it's a huge religion, and I'm sorry we lost her, because I wanted to ask her what
about
she
a million
thought.
Other things.
Oh yeah, but you know, obviously, her community or her circle of influence doesn't believe in this, and I was curious to know, as a whole of the Muslim faith. She said it was a billion or whatever. How many of those people actually are going for this?
Well, she said only 20% even go to mosque. That was new for me.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Which begs to the question, the ones that do go to the mosque, are they the ones we got to watch out for?
Yeah, who's actually drinking the Kool-Aid? Well, her article that we have linked for you on the webpage, entitled New York Attack, she says, once again, evil has struck New York City. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of the victims. But she says, facts are quite straightforward, and this is her list. It's cowardly. It will happen again. This is part of the war on the West declared by jihadists. There are no lone wolves.
And we've heard that from lots of people.
Wanted to ask her some more about that. This was done in the name of jihad. Politicians will deflect. My co-religionists will go on the defensive. The victimhood ideology will swing into action. And, oh, my gosh, we see that every time. Is there a solution? She says yes, but is anyone listening? No. There's a symbolic problem which is not being addressed head on. What actions being taken against Islamic fighters coming home to Western countries? That's a $64,000 question. What action is being taken to go to the root of radicalization and the teaching of hate? When converts are involved, who's converting them? And when radicalization is going on, are we peeping into the pulpit?
That's the big rub. You know, the freedom of religion keeps us from infiltrating these mosques, and yet we know that's where this message of hate is being taught, is in these mosques.
And it's a very small percentage of people who consider themselves to be Muslims.
Right.
Which is interesting. And I was curious about the prayer rug thing in the middle of the road in Paris. And I think that happens other places too. But every time I see that, I'm like, how are you guys falling for this, that this is a religion thing? This is obviously civil disobedience. And just designed to force them to kowtow to them, pretending it's a religious thing. Because in reality, I guess you can't put your prayer rug someplace that's dirty.
Right.
I read that and I thought,
you're
not allowed to wear your shoes in the mosque. So they're going to throw their prayer rugs down on the city street. I have noticed in some.
Ew.
Yeah, you can't even eat gum or something if it falls on the.
I also found it interesting that she referred to them as Islamists. And, you know, that they're the ones you got to watch out for.
But how do you know?
How do you know?
Like she said, she's got two sons that totally fit the profile in their 20s, beards, Muslims.
But she raised them and they don't believe that.
Right.
They don't believe.
And that's a really important distinction, but that makes it a million times harder. You know, pretend we're law enforcement, right? It's like, well, how did that help us?
Yeah. We need to get Bruce back on.
Give us the 411. Well, we're going to have Claire back on the 10th. So let me look at that. We were also, since we're killing a minute here, I just thought I'd let our listeners know kind of what our demographic looks like, because it's so interesting. And this is the demographic on the website. So these are the folks that are listening to the archive after the fact, not listening on the actual radio here in Redding, California on Sunday afternoon. So
this is the wethepeopleradio.us website.
Correct.
Okay.
And
so that doesn't even count who might also be listening
on the KCNR.
KCNR's website.
That's true. So these are only the stats that I can get from just our site. So about 36% comes from the United States of America. This is in the last 30 days. So, of course, it can change over time, but it's been pretty consistent. So 36% of our listeners are actually in the U.S. We have 11.5% who are in the Ukraine. And the Ukraine.
God bless them.
God bless the Ukrainians.
Yep.
Hey, all you Ukrainians out there, you should be sending us emails and letting us know what kind of topics you want
to
hear.
Since Putin's up to.
They're the largest out of the U.S. block of people who listen are the Ukrainians. Next comes France, Russia, China, Germany, the U.K., Ireland, and Canada.
Does that make us colluding with
Russians?
Oh, yeah,
totally.
I'm sure it does.
We're colluding, aren't we?
And And what is it, not the Moldovians, because Moldova's down there, but what are they called?
The Macedonians.
Macedonians, yeah. We don't have them. We did have them 1 month. But
well, they're all a bunch of hackers, /Hillary. They'll take over your
genius
site.
Genius hackers.
That's right.
So three cheers to the Ukrainians, and yeah. Thanks for joining us.
A bunch of meerkats down there.
I hope you guys had a fun time with the show. Between the unions and the Islamists, today was action-packed. We're doing something fun next week. I forgot what it is, but I know it was fun. And hold on, I'm looking really fast. Ooh, some self-defense stuff with Brad Steiner. And then we have Brad Grenier on about the opioid crisis. They actually have a thing that can solve it. So check us out online, wethepeopleradio.us.
That's right. The Europeans can hack that website anytime.
Absolutely.
Wethepeopleradio.us.
There you are.
And go Ukraine.
For those of you listening over the airwaves, this is KCNR Shasta Redding.